Everybody, welcome to episode 4 of Justice with Jax. I am your host, Jacqueline Arvindadas-Unsueta. You can call me Jax, and I am super duper happy to bring aboard my colleague today, Nathan Shulkin, for episode 4. Nathan, take it away. Tell people who you are.
Hello, my name is Nathan. I use he, they pronouns. I am just a general community member of Colorado Springs. I do a lot of work with a group called Southern Colorado Black and Pink. They are a prison abolition group. That is, I guess, Southern Colorado Black and Pink is a local chapter of a nationwide prison abolition group. So that's kind of what brings me into this space today.
Excellent. Well, the activism piece of things, yes. Right? Is that's kind of how we know each other and part of why you're on the episode for today, which today is Saturday, April 6th. It's actually 250 days since the filing of Arvindadas and Chinook Center versus the City of Colorado Springs et al., which is part of what this podcast is about, really a vehicle to give the community updates on this historic civil rights case and hopefully to shed some light on like the legal system journey and process with, as an abolitionist, we're going to get into the nitty gritty. Mm-hmm. I hope talking about that a bit. And so just also to the lived experiences that we've had as people touched by this case, which is such an important part of the story, right? Who can tell our story better than us, mm-hmm. right? And so starting off with some updates, you know, the wheels of justice, there's that saying, they can turn slowly, and like sometimes justice delayed is justice denied, right? Just feeling all the feelings about how long this is expected to take. And mm-hmm. so at this point, we still don't have a trial date, and we don't have any decisions on what the defendants have filed, which are called motions to dismiss. So those are some really you know, nuts and bolts pieces that we want to see develop. Mm-hmm. To me, the sooner the better, but those are still out there. And where we're at right now is that we are kind of at this limited discovery phase, which I'd mentioned before, and the development there, and what we're really looking at in terms of what the court is discussing, is this quote-unquote scope of employment issue, where the detective that was involved in writing the warrants in my case, and the targeting and whatnot, and really violating the Fourth Amendment for mm-hmm. me, which is my right to privacy with those warrants, what were they doing and for who were they doing it? Because as we've discussed a bit, is there's this joint terrorism task force that this detective from CSPD was a part of. Mm-hmm. And so is he a city cop? Was he working for the FBI? This is what the court will be discussing. And so the attorneys talking to each other, right? Over time since we filed, it turned out the city, you know, was hesitating on giving additional documentation around this employment question, because they are alleging that this officer was really a federal employee at the time.
Keep switching things like back and forth. Not even just between two places, but like federal, state, municipal, like they're just,
it's kind of muddying, mixing it as much. Yeah. Feels mm-hmm. a bit. Yeah. Well, there is such an important concept that we've brought up on this podcast before, which is this, what does this qualified immunity mean? And so it's very interesting for me, like I've mentioned, like I used to sit in courtrooms and listen to the proceedings in my journalism career. And so not only is this scope of employment question being analyzed, and it's also some arguments being made under what's called the Westfall Act, which pretty much every episode I have to say, I am not a lawyer. I'm not trying to play one on TV either. But I can do research and be factual. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I discovered is, you know, an attorney who really summarized that Westfall Act is something where federal employees enjoy immunity from liability and suit, provided the conduct that allegedly caused the plaintiff harm, the plaintiff, that's me and Chinook Center, caused the harm was within the scope of their employment. So non-attorney, we'll see what the court does with that, but we know that that's something that the court is using as we make the arguments both on our side and the defendants are making theirs. And I do want to share finally a really, I think, important piece to keep people motivated, is that as of the recent conferencing, we did have the magistrate judge ordered the city to release more documents to answer what our ACLU attorneys have requested, to make these arguments around employment.
Okay.
So, yeah, we can call it a win. Mm-hmm. You got to take the wins where they come mm-hmm. because it's a marathon, not a sprint right. with this. And so, Nathan, let's talk about how you are connected to this case and why it's important. I thought to really hear your piece of this story, because if there's anything that we emphasize with this is that, my name on it, Chinook Center, they're a big piece of community, but what this really is about the community in totality in what we've been through. And so you were there that day at the housing march, that this case is kind of, that was the catalyst for what this case is, which is a much bigger story. So let's start there, and then we can take our pick of what else we want to talk about. Tell me your experience of that day, what you remember, and what you remember when we learned this was so much bigger than just that day.
Yeah, I think, so my day or my remembering of that day is, I guess, just, I don't even know how to explain everything up to it, because it kind of went exactly how we thought it would, where we did just show up at a public park, hand out food, clothing, tents to a bunch of different people who needed them, and then we were, as a group going to march to, I believe, just an empty building downtown to highlight, this is a building that could be used for housing. There's so many empty buildings that could be used for housing. Why are we not doing that? It happened to fall on the same day as the Colorado Springs bicentennial, I think it was. So there was also
the sesquicentennial.
Yes. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So there was a big parade or something happening downtown as well. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but basically, we were marching. And then right when we started the march, it was very clear that there was a very, very big police presence. And this was summer of 2021, I think. And so we'd all gone through the summer of 2020 as well. And so we were all used to, I don't want to say we're all used to it, but a good chunk of us had protested before. We'd been to protests. We've been to very sizable protests where
I think we probably were at protests together without even knowing it.
Right, exactly. and much bigger ones, I'll just say more chaotic ones where you see police in riot gear and you're like, it never makes sense. But when they're defending their own, the CSPD building, I get why there's cops in riot gear there, but we're literally just marching and there's, cops in riot gear, all this stuff like that. And so they're making a bunch of announcements to stay off of the street, to walk on the sidewalk. So then we're walking on the sidewalk. And then, I think y'all talked about it in previous episodes. They literally make an announcement saying, Sean Walls, you're under arrest. Mm-hmm. And it's just the entire event, looking back, it makes perfect sense why it was so weird and why it felt like people were being targeted.
It felt really amped.
Amped. The energy was so, amped is a good word, because it's why was the energy this way? Yeah, not in a good way. Why was the energy like this for what we were doing? It did not
match. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I remember it was we're marching and there's a wall of cops. And so we're getting up.
They cut us off points and we redirected our route.
The first thing that I guess they tried to get me in trouble for or said that I did wrong was someone grabbed my arm. Mm-hmm. And later when we watch body cam and we see everything, I'm like, oh, that was a cop grabbing my arm. Mm-hmm. But no one said, you're under arrest. No one said stop. Someone just grabbed my arm. So I pulled back.
It was a millisecond reaction.
Yeah. And so I pulled back and left that, little circle area thing. Mm-hmm. And then we keep moving. And then later on, I don't know how much later on this is. It felt 20 or 30 minutes later. I turn back and I look and there's just a bunch of people jumping on someone, or a bunch of cops jumping on someone specifically.
Right. To me, I thought that they had jumped on the entire crowd. It looked like it was more than just one person.
And then finding out it was just Charles is oh, whoa. So my millisecond instinct reaction is, well, I should go to help. I kind of move forward. Turns out I was running. And it turns out if you run towards cops, they're going to say that you are endangering them.
They're going to say whatever they need to say to criminalize you as necessary.
And so then they jumped on me, tackled me. I don't know how many, I think 4 or 5 people on me. Yeah. Both simultaneously yelling to put my hands behind my back while also pinning me down where my hands are in front of me, and I couldn't do that. I still have a scar. I don't know if the camera's going to pick it up, but we still got a scar from that day, so that's fun.
Yeah.
And then, they just throw you in the cop car. Put you in a holding cell for a bit. Mm-hmm. A person who was supposed to be a medic came and checked out my, it was literally an open wound, bleeding, and they just looked at it and said, yeah, that's fine. You're good.
Live. Mm-hmm. Not very humane is kind of the sense of what I am hearing, don't let me put words in your mouth. So,
oh no, but, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, and can I ask, part of some of the themes I feel that have come up here is for those of us caught up being arrested as a result of either that day or in my case, they came for me later. Mm-hmm. But it was really based on like a very human reaction, like a millisecond where you couldn't have possibly thought through what was going on. You could even, for me, I'll speak for myself, categorize it as like a fight or flight kind of mm-hmm. reaction, right? And it had to do with the energy that day that was just kind of antagonistic off the bat, was the sense of it for me. And so it's like, it is a very unfortunate situation if I reflect, and I'd love to hear what you think on reflection-wise, right? But is that it almost felt to me like we were baited. Mm-hmm. Because any natural person is going to have a reaction, and we were criminalized for our natural reaction to what was going on that day, which was violent. It left you with a scar, and so much more impact for the community at large, because six people were then mm-hmm. forced through the court system. And I also want to hear your journey.
And also Dorchester Park, like, to this day is still like, there's cinder blocks in the parking lot. Like, it's a public park that's for some reason like shut down,
right?
And they point to
closed off. Yeah,
that's one of the things they point to. There's a few reasons they point to that, but like, that's mm-hmm. one of the things they point to for why this can't be like open to the public. So it's, yeah, definitely still impacting things today in
yeah.
a lot of different ways.
Do you mind talking about the impact that it had? Like, in reality, there were certain charges that you faced, right? And they forced you to go through like municipal court.
Mm-hmm.
And so the outcomes of that, and frankly, just, I'm sure, like, what a pain in the ass it was. And I know there were some really questionable things that you were ordered to do by the court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big pain in the ass, and luckily it was just for me individually, at least, just kind of like a laughable pain in the ass at how ridiculous this mm-hmm. all is. I remember leaving the police station when they were writing up my charges, mm-hmm. and they initially wrote down that I was resisting arrest. That was like my initial charge,
a classic one, which they write down all the time.
And
no,
I said
what.
Out loud, like, how, what's the other charge? How is my only charge resisting arrest? Like, what mm-hmm. was I, what arrest was I resisting? Like, what was I even resisting? Mm-hmm. And then they later changed it to interfering with a public official.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, because mm-hmm. they were arresting Charles and I moved towards them,
mm-hmm.
it's interfering with them. And so it was two counts, that, and then because I pulled away from that one person that they mm-hmm. said I pulled away from. So there were
that
two
was
counts.
The resisting.
There were two counts of interfering
oh,
with public,
interfering.
Interference
okay.
with a public official. So those uh-huh. were the two counts. And then we went to court, pled not guilty, and mm-hmm. I got guilty on one and not guilty on the other. What that led to was just, I think, a year on probation, but like municipal court probation.
Right.
So it was, I think, 10 hours of community service, which was, again, funny because we all, by the court's definition, we do
community service
for our day jobs.
All the
yeah.
time.
And so that, I do have, at least in municipal court, a record of the judge saying, I'm a member of Blackpink, which is a K-pop girl
oh.
group that Black and Pink gets confused with a lot. So that
I
was funny.
See.
Yes. I had to do videos that were like how to be a better person.
That's the
videos,
questionable part.
Which,
I remember
yeah, were specifically,
about.
A chunk
yeah.
of them were specifically PragerU videos.
Which, unpack for the people at home. What is PragerU, my friend?
A very conservative,
not reliable source
not reliable.
Of information.
I wouldn't even call it a university, but the U stands for university, I believe. And so it's, yeah, classes on how to be a better person taught specifically by this kind of like right-wing, very conservative idea
yeah.
of, okay, this is what it means to be a good person in your community.
Did
there
you
were
have
also,
to buy those, by the way?
I,
or like,
so there were a bunch of fees I didn't specific.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I paid for the class. And so I
right.
think I paid, you know, this fee here and this fee there and this fee there. And so I don't
yeah.
know that I directly paid to like watch those videos, but it was part of the class that I had to take.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely feels like it. And just, yeah, that kind of... When you're going through it and you're able to laugh at it, it's very nice. But then I also, you know, had friends, you're getting charged with a felony. I heard
yeah.
how they were talking to Charles about what are your gang affiliations? And it's like, oh,
yeah.
it's just so clear what they're doing.
What
and so I can
yeah.
kind of laugh at myself, but then I look at, you know, my friends and it's just enraging.
I appreciate that. And mm-hmm. well, let's, I mean, if I may, let's take a deeper dive into that, because it has to do, and I think I've maybe talked about it on some episodes, but just like privilege, we all have different levels of that. And that's something, like, I don't think I've got to tell you this before, but you're a big part of like my even knowledge about what the prison industrial complex is because of your work with Black and Pink. Like, Black and Pink was a space for me to really take abolition to heart after what happened to us, and not, you know, trying to process the trauma and trying to balance it out with, transmute it with like action, you know. And so number one, thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Number two, like, that's a probably a whole other podcast as well, but what is interesting about our case is the different intersectionalities and how there are six different people who had six different experiences through the legal system. And now, flash forward, there's a civil rights case about it. So if anything, what would you think is important for people to understand about that privilege, intersectionality, abolition? Those are like some deep themes.
Yeah, I think it's just understanding your own place in all of it, and understanding where you can fit in and how you can fit in, and the work that you can do and the work that you can't do. I'll be honest, like, my part of prison abolition is not, I do not want to be inside prisons, like, fighting that fight. I don't think anybody does. That's the whole goal of prison abolition, is to get people out of prisons.
Right.
So what does that look like? And for me, that's a lot of letter writing. It's a lot of sometimes emailing, trying to help other people. People who are currently incarcerated get connected to outside resources, you know, through this way and through that way. So yeah, I think that's just understanding your own place in this world, so that then you can plug into the community. Not trying to make anything individualistic, or trying to take like a selfish savior approach to things, but really understanding yourself, so you can understand how you can best help and how you can best get help, because we do all need help at the end of the day.
Yeah, we do. And that's one of the beautiful things, like, with, and beautiful is such a weird way to put it in a sense, because like what happened was pretty ugly. But out of that, to me, what was beautiful is how we came together. Like, I remember going to one of your court dates, and it was so interesting to me. It was like the jury selection. And
yeah, that was a weird experience.
Let's talk about it. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I remember is that it was still jury selection, and they get to pull the jurors up one by one. And what figured prominently, obviously, in all our cases was the First Amendment, like, ramifications of what we were doing, and the context of Black Lives Matter summer and the murder of Devon Bailey. All those things came up, really. And I remember this, I'll call myself out, like, someone who I would make assumptions about, an older Caucasian man.
We'd want to ask where he was on January 6th.
Well put, my friend, yes. And so he had answered affirmatively something about being a gun owner, or something to that effect. But interestingly, his commentary was that what he remembered about the Devon Bailey case is he basically said, like, I'm a gun user, and even I know you don't shoot people in the back. Do you remember that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember him. I remember there was another person, or maybe it was a few people, and that shared the sentiment.
Our neighbors, right? Yeah. These are Colorado Springs people. Yeah.
But then it was also surprising because, again, the spying aspect of it was brought up. At that point, we knew CSPD was, like, spying on us. So that was brought up with the jury selection, and people were literally saying, oh, I just can't believe CSPD would do something like this. There's no way CSPD would do something like this. You see this in the movies. You saw this with COINTELPRO back, back in the day. But there's no way, like, CSPD would be involved with something like this. And so I think it was just so,
it was shocking.
To hear that, because it's like, oh no, we've just spent a year diving into the fact that they 100% are involved in something like this, because they're just a regular police department. This is what police departments do.
Right, under the guise of that, you know, joint terrorism task force, which is part of what makes this case so important, right? And I know we touched on it, too, in previous discussions, is that, interestingly, you know, technically the spying isn't what is on trial here. Mm-hmm. It's the violation of my privacy with, you know, them taking all my devices. And even though I've never been convicted of a crime, now the FBI has an entire profile of every single digital device in my home at the time that I was violated. Not okay. Mm-mm. And it's very surreal to see them make an argument of like, and so, and what? So what are you going to do? Sue me, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. We bring a lawsuit. That's part of the system that we live in. And so it's been surreal. And I think important to share those memories of this lived experience. So you went through a year of probation, and then thankfully, how are we today? When did that probation end? Really, back in 2022 now?
Would summer it be? Of 2022 it had to have been, yeah.
That's good.
Right?
Well, no,
because we got arrested 2021, and then I didn't get... That's right, no, it was... so we got arrested 2021, the whole court stuff took a year. And so I was on probation for the year of summer 2022 to summer 2023.
Gotcha. Okay.
So yeah, I guess it just wrapped up. Not just, it was like 8-9 months ago now. But yeah, summer 2023 is when it wrapped up.
Well, and you know what I didn't realize until I talked to Charles, who we met in episode 3, is that he was still on court like paper for everything that he was accused of in his whole ordeal until like more recently. I think it like just barely ended, or he was like right towards ending it, and see the vast differences in people's experiences in these systems. And so how about this for people who may not be familiar with the term prison industrial complex? Let's talk about that a little bit, because again, that's a large scale subject, but here it's relevant because as a complex, we went through one part of the legal system, but there's so much more to unpack about it.
Yeah, so the prison industrial complex is, I guess, a big word for all the different mechanisms, maneuvers, systems that keep people wrapped up in the cycle of incarceration. So whether it's what we went through, where we just for some reason had to spend 2 years going through, or me personally had to spend 2 years going through this like municipal court system that, again, the entire way my lawyer's saying this should not have taken this long, this should be like, you know, in and out kind of thing, and for some reason it's getting stretched on like this, whether it's, or a lot more extreme examples where people get death sentences and people fight, you know, very hard to get those overturned, and the only option is life in prison, no parole. And so it's just two different sides, I guess, to this just giant system that keeps people trapped inside of it, keeps people not only incarcerated, because it's not just being locked in prisons or jails, but it's also when you get out of incarceration, now you have an ankle monitor for 6 months and you have like a
state
restriction
supervision.
Of movement. You're released and you're completely, you know, no support. Maybe you have 3 or 4 friends. And because you were just incarcerated for 20 plus years, you... just the finances aren't there, so you just have to take whatever options you can, and that just puts you in more precarious situations. So yeah, I don't know, just a lot of different things that create what I have a friend who does a lot of work with necropolitics, which is another fancy word, but it just, the prison industrial complex is a big part of necropolitics, which looks at death worlds and how some people, it's not even the prison sentence that does it. It's just some people are like pushed into these death worlds where they're not given the chance to live the way other people are. And you're just forced into this prison life, forced into a life where the only option.
The illusion of a choice.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well said. Yeah, thank you. And I'm, just for the record, these are not softballs. These are really hard questions.
It's so hard to not just like get lost running my train of thought for 20 minutes. Cause I can just talk, I feel like, about this stuff.
Well, you're great at it, and that's part of why I really appreciated being able to work with Black and Pink following this experience, because I really didn't have that knowledge or reference point. Like, this experience turned me into an abolitionist. Like, I walked away from this being like, I have seen too much. Like, I cannot go back. Like,
yeah, it was definitely weird, because I think I'd been with Black and Pink for a year or two before we got arrested and went through this whole thing. And a like big part for me was educating myself. And so reading a lot of books on the prison system and the legal system. And so you read a bunch of different books about how the legal system works. And again, you think like, oh, okay,
You think you know.
You think you know. And then you go through it and it's like, oh, this is all like both 100% true and 100% kind of like surprising at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird how the human experience can, it feels like, hold polar opposites that are both true at the same time. Right. Yeah. And it's something that over time I've been processing in different ways. But for me as an individual, I have, you know, the issue of like the mental trauma and experience that it left me. And that's such a weighty thing that even still to this day, like I went to the conference recently between the lawyers and the judge and all that. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having like a bad dream that was kind of a repeat of what I lived that day. And it pissed me off. I was like, yeah. I just wasn't expecting that. And I didn't even talk during the conference, right? Mm-hmm. I was just there to like represent and show the defendants in the court, like, I really care about this case as the plaintiff. And it, you know, is a lot of legal jargon and stuff, but it's still something in there in my brain. Like, it triggered that, and I was really mad about it, honestly.
Yeah, that's a totally fair response.
Yeah, it's one that you can't really control, mm-hmm. speaking of just the human experience and the reactions that we have to different things. And so, do you mind sharing a little bit maybe around, like, when you were living through this, the people around you, like, the depth of what we discovered not only affected us, but like our greater communities and the people who support us. And so what were some of the things you maybe remember people discussing with you, if anything, once we learned the gravity of what really was happening, which is a spying, targeting, yeah. retaliation?
Mm-hmm. I think it was just, I'm trying to even think of, because there was the immediate reaction of us getting arrested, and I felt so much community support and love from my yeah. friends who, I'll never forget, my friend texted me, and this is how I know they knew me so well, where they messaged me and they said, hey, I heard what happened. I know you sometimes like to be alone to process things, so if you just want to hang out with your cats, that's fine, but also I can make you some tea if you want to come over. And that was just like such a heartwarming response, because I just felt so cared for in that moment and known and loved. Yeah. So that was kind of like the immediate response, which was very sweet and heartwarming. And then, yeah, once we got the body cam footage and started pouring through it, I think it felt more of relief, or like we can, I don't want to say celebrate at all, but it was like we knew something was up. Mm-hmm. You know, knew something was up. We just had to find it. And so we'd finally, you know, I didn't spend that much time pouring through the body cam footage. Other people, yeah. I think Sam did so much of it.
Sam and John,
yeah.
They did a lot of work.
And so it was just this moment of like, oh, wow, we really found something. And then, yeah, you kind of just like, people kept pulling on the thread and pulling on the thread. And like, we're still pulling on the thread today.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. There are so many threads to pull. Well said there. And so tell me about what it felt like when you heard we had finally gotten to be represented by ACLU and we made the filing, because I know a little bit prior to that we had done a panel for the podcast that kind of teased our story in an episode with the wonderful reporter from The Intercept, Trevor Aronson. Mm-hmm. So we had some time to talk about this publicly. But for me, it didn't feel real right until there was something with much more teeth.
Yeah. I think it felt good. It's one of those things where this is something me and my pen pal say to each other a lot, is just hurry up and wait, where that's kind of sometimes all you can do a lot with the prison system. But just even life in general is like, yes. hurry up and wait. And so many moments in this journey have felt like we're just hurrying up and waiting. But I think it's definitely good to do this process. John talked about how, I think he said, it's sometimes frustrating going through the legal process because you want things to happen so much quicker and you want things to happen differently, and they just don't. But, you know, we're doing what we can. And so
it's one mechanism.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And I think I wouldn't, you know, equate them. But to me, this podcast is important because I know I've said it in conversations. I don't know if I've said it on the show yet, but it wouldn't surprise anyone if I said I don't have a lot of trust or faith in the legal system. Mm-hmm. And there are other experiences beyond this that have contributed to it, but this one pretty much the most profound, I'd say, so far. That being said, given there are no guarantees for the outcomes, I think this show is really important because we know the power dynamic here. We know the narrative about this that was forced on the community from day mm-hmm. one and beyond. And so this show is the balance to that. We're going to have something out of this case, regardless of the outcome, as we hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I am committed to taking this time and just grateful that people are coming along on the ride, because it is so important to honor. I got some feedback. People were like, just keep talking about, like, why are you doing this? So let's talk about why. For me, this case, the big three that stood out were, essentially, I'm oversimplifying, but this case is about our government, right? Or police, the extension of our government, criminalizing us for our political beliefs and speech. And the big three for me were Black Lives Matter, white supremacy is domestic terrorism, and housing is a human right. That's mm-hmm. that's why we're here. That's why we've been doing this before we had something like this that could trigger a civil rights case, mm-hmm. you know? So how do you feel about that? Like, I would say maybe the word is a challenge, but it's so easy to maybe get bogged down by all the noise that there is. Like, something John said was, like, we also talked about the minutia matters. Yeah. So how, striking the balance between those things, how do you do that as an abolitionist activist continuing your work through Black and Pink?
Oh, yeah. So I guess a nice kind of part about a lot of this work is there are just, like, there's minutia, there's little tasks to do throughout the day. And so you can just, like, turn to your little tasks where it doesn't feel like you're doing the biggest thing. Maybe I'm just writing one letter. Maybe I'm just finding, like, 10 photos for someone. Maybe I'm finding mm-hmm. lyrics for someone. Maybe I'm working on, like, this section of our newsletter. Just these kind of small things. But they do add up. And, you know, at the end of the day or at the end of the week or at the end of the month, you have 30, 40, 50 letters mm-hmm. that you're sending out to so many different people. And then, yeah, that feedback that you get back where this did make a difference, this made me smile, or this, like, made my week because I don't get a whole lot of mail. So I think just those kind of things where it is, again, going back to, like, finding how do you plug into, and it's not just prison abolition. There's, you know, this is just community organizing in general, where mm-hmm. how do you find your space, plug into your space, and, like, do the work that needs to be done. And so I think however much you can do is an awesome amount, because, like, it all needs to get done. And that's, I think, a lot of
and
what
there's plenty to do.
There's plenty to do. That's definitely what I try and stress with people when they, like, ask, how do I get involved with, like, Black and Pink? What mm-hmm. can I do? How can I help? And it's like, anything you can do is so much help. Writing one letter is so much better than not writing any letters, or not writing one letter, because that's, like, one more mm-hmm. letter. It's just, all of this is one more thing, you know, like mm-hmm. one more step in the right direction, if we can go in that direction. Yeah. And so I think for me, like, trying to both move forward, but also understand, I don't know, you do feel like Sisyphus sometimes, right? Like, you're trying to move forward, you're trying to move up this mountain, but there is a boulder here. Yeah. And so even if I'm just holding the boulder, that is better than, like, losing ground, I guess. Yeah. Or even if you have to let the boulder go sometimes, you would have to do that anyway, you know? Like, you have to just keep rolling this boulder up the hill.
That's fair. And can I talk about something that has helped me kind of absorb, for lack of a better word, like, what it means to strive for abolition of the prison industrial complex?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Is there was a time in our country when people thought the abolition of slavery mm-hmm. was impossible. And so I take that to heart, because that's the struggle we have with the abolition of the prison industrial complex, right? People think that's impossible. And there was all the ruckus around things like defund the police. Mm-hmm. And I think those discussions are hard for people, because nowadays I call it, like, a bumper sticker mentality,
yeah.
which is, you can only say it in three words, and that's how I'll remember it. And therefore, we lose all nuance mm-hmm. and, like, the ability to be accurate or thoughtful. And so all that is to say, abolition of the industrial complex is a very complicated topic, but I think you can take it to places like that example with us ending slavery in this country.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. There is just, what is the word? Because like the prison industrial complex does include slavery, right?
Slavery still exists today.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if people can actually read my sweater, but it says roses are red, Doritos are savory. The U.S. prison system is legalized slavery.
There you go. Thank you for...
And so, yes, we have technically, I guess, abolished slavery in this country, but it does still exist in this country. And so how do we reckon with that? And I definitely do want to say we have made so much progress. There is so much progress we've made, and there's still so much progress that needs to be made. So it's, again, that thing of like, as long as we're all heading in the right direction, that's what I'm just striving for, and that's what I'm trying to get people to join in on. Because no one is saying we should go, no one is trying to, when people say slavery wasn't abolished, it moved into the prison system, no one is trying to go back and say like, oh, we should change the laws to be what they were 200 years ago. People are just trying to point out, we're all just trying to point out that the way this system works is to just move and change and adapt so that it can keep doing the same things, but just call it something else. And so, yeah, I think that is a very good thing to look at, is we have changed so much, and change is so possible because, like, we are the ones who built these systems. We are the ones who created these systems, and we are the ones who can rebuild or destroy and create something new. So, yeah, I definitely think that's...
I appreciate that. Yeah. It, again, not exactly softball questions, but things like we wanted to talk about, I know. And something we wanted to talk about, too, which is... one of these pieces that we've mentioned on the show, and so much, how could you know what this journey would entail, right? It's not something we asked for, but I know I've named it Franklin's, one of the ugly pieces of this is us eventually understanding that the timeline of us being prosecuted more or less as a group was right along the timeline of when our local authorities, our fourth judicial district attorney office, they could have been prosecuting the club, the eventual Club Q shooter. And so do you mind talking about your thoughts around that? Because I know that's something that cuts.
Yeah. Again, I just, it's something that you think about and you just get so angry and upset. Because it is exactly how everyone says the judicial system works and how cops work and how the prison system works. It's just ignoring the actual problems and then focusing on people for wearing red clothes. And then, an event like this happens. For those who don't know, Club Q is a gay bar in Colorado Springs. Southern Colorado Black and Pink, and Black and Pink as a whole is specifically focusing on queer incarcerated people and HIV AIDS positive people incarcerated. So that was kind of a lot of overlap with those kind of things. I also lived, I think, a minute or two away from Club Q when it all happened. So yeah, and then another thing of just like, as someone in the prison abolition community, how do you handle these giant events where like all of the systems failed? It was the cops who failed. It was the justice system that failed. And yet we as the community are left here to try and pick things up.
With the wound.
With the wound, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, just so many difficult questions being asked of like, what do we do? How do we, you know, we can't accept this violence, but at the same time, like this is the world we live in. So how do we adjust and survive as best we can? And also like hold each other accountable as best we can. Yeah, I don't know.
There aren't easy answers. There aren't. And I think if anything, maybe that's where we start, right? Is by naming the fact that these things are on our hearts and there's not easy answers, but one way we, I don't think we move forward is by not talking about it, right?
Yeah.
That's
well,
the
and
one
by
that gets me.
Doing stuff. Like we...
More than talk.
More than talk. But yeah, we are like, I don't know, you and I, so many others in the community, we organize to like do things. And that's what I just try and highlight every time with like this kind of event or the process we're talking about here is, while the cops are doing nothing and while judges are literally not reading anything, they're just signing off on things. Like we
the
are the ones,
in this case,
right. Like, we are the ones here trying to do things. Like my friends, I did as much as I could, but my friends stepped in so hard when Club Q happened, to try and help people who were impacted. All, you know, so many different people who were impacted. Or I think about what just happened a few months ago, where it was a freeze here in Colorado Springs, and there were supposed to be warming shelters that the city said they would set up, and then at the last second they just pulled back. And again, like, us and a bunch of our friends, you know, set up warming centers and kept for, I think, 5 days in a row, kept the place
Chinook
open for
Center
Chinook
was Center. One of them, right?
Yeah, yeah. Kept the place open for 24 hours, 5 days in a row, to just make sure people had a place to stay.
Doing is important, too.
Doing is important stuff, right?
Rather than this dang talk show stuff. No, it takes a little bit of everything, we'll say.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of the doing, I think this is a great time. Can you share for people who are listening all the ways that if they want to do, that they can get involved with Black and Pink, or what you have coming up, or any other, what's good in the neighborhood right now?
We have some events coming up in April. I don't know exactly. I think this episode's getting released on like this.
But this should be going the third Friday of April.
Okay. We're doing an event in Boulder on April 13th with Boulder DSA. Don't know. This might come out after that, but that'll be fun. Doing
but
letter
look it up.
But look it up.
What's the event activity? What's
we do pen pal matching and letter writing. So we have, I think, 80 plus people now. We have a lot of people that write to us that want a pen pal, and so we try and connect them with a pen pal. Then we also just get a bunch of letters from people, and so we write back as a group. So both kind of individual or group stuff, whichever you want. Angela Davis is coming to CC the 26th, which we are very excited about. Might get the chance to meet her, which
that's
is just
awesome.
Blowing my mind.
She's coming, like, she came around April last year, too.
She came
like,
April
we're getting
last
an
year
Angela
and,
Davis visit every year. I love it.
Yeah, so the reason she's coming back is because my partner, Irina, who I'm, you've met.
Yeah, I think I've met them.
Yeah, they asked an incredible question last year that they still get like...
I got in trouble in a break room because of that question.
Okay, there you go. Right, so they kind of have gotten, I don't know, a bit of notoriety from that. Anyway,
good.
They are part of the reason Angela Davis is coming back to CC, because they That's wanted to bring fantastic. Angela Davis back to kind of ask those similar kind of questions. So that is happening, but sorry... Getting
no,
off track. To get involved with Black and Pink, no such thing. To get involved with Southern Colorado Black and Pink, you can reach out to us at southerncolorado@blackandpink.org. That is our email. We're also available at a website, coblackandpink.org. Yeah, we do a lot of letter writing, so it's not as... You can definitely do stuff digitally. There's a lot to get done, but it is a lot of like physical mail stuff as well.
And the folks that are seeking pen pals, they are incarcerated people across Colorado, or is that the whole country now, or how do...
Yeah, so in again, Black and Pink is a nationwide organization or made up of different local chapters. We are one of those local chapters. So we, I guess we're Southern Colorado Black and Pink. We might change to just Colorado Black and Pink at some point, but we try and focus on specifically Colorado. However, the way prison systems work is people get moved around a lot.
Right.
So we'll have people get transferred to like Arizona, or there's just so few resources inside for some people. We'll have, we've had people write from Texas or Arkansas and just be like, hey, I found this address. Like, will you write back to me?
Wow.
And it's just really hard to say no. So we'll write back. Yeah.
My respect for that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And some of the work that you do with Black and Pink, which obviously I know this is a challenge, but there's like an advocacy layer to it as well sometimes. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that in case, you know, anyone listening might be able to lend their people power to those kinds of efforts?
Yeah. There's just so many different ways to advocate for incarcerated people, I think, because of how terrible prisons are. So we do a lot of phone zaps for people when they need things. Sometimes things Sometimes things just get real extreme when you're incarcerated, where you just have like an immediate health need and you can't wait. Normally when you're in prison or jail and you need some sort of health thing, medicine or anything like that, if you're not getting it regularly, you have to make a request, and that can take 2 to 3 to 4 weeks, and then your request could just get denied.
Right.
So we'll have people write to us and just be like, hey, this just cannot wait. I need to either be moved. I need like this kind of help. I need this kind of help. I need this kind of help. And they'll just say, can you just like make noise about it? Can you just get someone to get some attention? And so phone zaps are ways to kind of make noise to the facility, where we'll call the facility. Try and coordinate it a bit so you're getting a lot of calls at once. And so it's at least like...
There's a public pressure.
Public pressure.
The
only
way anything
works under, way anything gets done under bureaucracy is someone gets annoyed and does it. And so you have to annoy someone at the facility so that they just do the thing and get you off their back. So that's definitely one way we advocate. I think showing up for people when they get released, decarcerating people is just as important. So being there when people get released and just trying to help them enter the community as much as possible.
Yeah, definitely important piece of the work, no doubt. Thank you for that. And so anything else community-wise before we maybe wrap ourselves up here?
Oof. Just keep doing it. Keep being in community. I think I just love seeing so many different groups, you know, all of it can feel like you're just screaming into a void sometimes, especially with prison abolition, where it feels
pretty wild out there these days.
Yeah, definitely wild. But just doing so much work, doing this work for years, and then looking over and seeing like, oh, the library is unionized because of my friends, you know, doing that kind of work. And oh, people in CSPC are making so much noise for Palestine, which, like, yes, free Palestine, fuck Israel. And just so much different community is happening, and it continues to happen. And I think that's something that is like my big takeaway from this experience.
Definitely.
So many people talked about how they're trying to send a message, they're trying to silence y'all, they're trying to get you to shut up. I had conversations with like family and friends where it's like, okay, so you're done with this now, right, Nathan? Like, you're done, you're gonna kind of be quiet now. And just the way no
quite
one has.
The opposite.
Quite the opposite for literally all of us involved. And so I think that's just,
I love that.
Yeah, very heartwarming.
Yes, heartwarming is the word. It went international, as a matter of fact. Really, The Guardian had an article about it, because really this rises to the level of federal law enforcement, like spying on our own people, right?
Well, and so many people were pointing out when it made like this big kind of news, they were kind of like laughing and being like, look, the cops are spying on people and all they're finding is like, they're
people
trying to feed people and they're
work.
Trying to write letters to people. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've just also been laughing about that this whole time, where it's just
such an important part of piece of it, which is what I hope this podcast is doing, is showing the absurdity of it,
right.
Which literally every person who will be interviewed on this show, or especially who was arrested for that housing march, is doing nothing but trying to contribute good things to the community and build community and lift our community up. And so, you know, I think I don't think that they thought through how this would give us another platform to like do what we do. And it's something I think Sean touched on it, but it's just like out of their own petty, terrible conduct, it really just backfired on
them.
Yeah. So on that note then, okay, I'm going to wrap this up here, and we are going to just make a few more closing announcements for Justice with Jax. Thanks for joining episode 4. Remember, as always, to ask yourself 2 questions. Who's telling your story? And how are you being the change you want to see in the world today? And so a thank you once again to Studio 809 Podcasts. Our episodes are recorded here as a member of the collective at the Next Us Community co-working space in downtown Colorado Springs. This is Justice with Jax, signing off.